Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
When loaded with torpedoes, could go after ships, but they were really Swiss Army knives. I mean, a torpedo bomber like the Avenger could do so much more than torpedo bombing. For example, they could be used as level bombers. They have a bomb bay. They could do ground support runs because you could mount rockets on the wings. They, of course, could do anti-submarine work because they could carry a depth charge. They had radar, so they could do some kind of radar picket work. They could be scout planes.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Stephen Bailey. Stephen is the chair of the Department of English Language and Literature for the Central Michigan University. He's authored multiple books on Army, Navy, and aviation topics, and in particular, he's an expert on the topic of Hong Kong in World War II. His latest book, Target Hong Kong, is a really great and informative read on a topic less well covered elsewhere, and it really enlightened me to the Naval Air and Ground War as part of Operation Gratitude. So, Steve, welcome to Extended.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us about a subject that's not really that well published elsewhere. But before we talk about Operation Gratitude, can you give us a little bit about your background and experience and what you've done before this book?
Yeah. Usually the way I approach this kind of question is to talk a little bit about how I got to the point where I could write a book like Target Hong Kong. And the story begins really several decades ago, probably about two decades ago, maybe more, when I was in Hong Kong and had started getting really interested in Hong Kong's green spaces. Most pictures of Hong Kong show skyscrapers and a very urban setting and so on. But Hong Kong actually has an excellent collection of country parks. That's the local term for them. And I was really enjoying hiking in them. They've got some spectacular hiking trails and great views of the sea and the ocean and the city and so on. But I remember one particular day I was hiking down the backside of Hong Kong Island. And that was the Pak Fu Lam Trail. It's a paved trail. It was a road originally. It's a hiking trail now. And as I was heading downhill, it was quite hot. And it was very steep, I remember. And as I was making my way through the what was essentially sort of subtropical vegetation, I kept seeing these bunkers by the side of the road, by the side of the trail. And the first set of bunkers, it looked sort of like they were shelters of some kind. And the windows and doors were bricked up, but you could see that there had once been steel shutters, steel doors that would have sealed them off. So I was like, I don't know what these are, you know. And then I kept going down this trail and got down to the reservoir. And I realized in the undergrowth, there were still more bunkers. And these were actual bunkers. I could see where the machine gun embrasures would have been and that these were actually defensive positions. So at this point, I was pretty curious because I'd always been interested in World War II and I'd been reading books about World War II since I was a kid. And so at that point, I was hooked. I was like, I got to know more about Hong Kong and its wartime history. And I started a more systematic approach to learning about it. And I didn't know anything really, other than a vague sense that the Japanese had taken Hong Kong during the Second World War. But as I did more research and started reading up on it, I discovered quite a few historians and scholars and writers had written about the ground campaign to take Hong Kong, because the Japanese military seized Hong Kong at the very start of the war. The Japanese invasion of Hong Kong occurred simultaneously with the air raid, the airstrike on Pearl Harbor, though the dateline meant the days were different. So it was December 7th, 1941 for Pearl Harbor, December 8th, 1941 for Hong Kong. The Japanese army came across the border. There was a two-week and quite bloody battle for Hong Kong, and the Japanese emerged victorious, as was really inevitable, given the fact Hong Kong was so isolated and cut off from other Allied forces, and the fact the Japanese had superiority in numbers and in just about every possible weapon system except perhaps artillery. So Hong Kong fell, and the garrison suffered heavy casualties and went into POW camps, where the members of the garrison suffered horribly. And ultimately, by the end of the war and liberation, the original garrison at Hong Kong had been substantially reduced due to casualties and losses in the POW camps. Anyways, I read all about this, and I explored various other trails and looked at other bunkers and fortifications and various wartime sites, and discovered they're all over Hong Kong Island. There's also some larger fortifications as well, such as the Pinewood Battery, which was an anti-aircraft position. And in the process of doing all this research, though, what I kept coming across were these references to American air raids against Japanese-occupied Hong Kong. And the references were always kind of just slipped in. So I might be reading a memoir about somebody who was a prisoner of war in Hong Kong, and then they'd mention American bombing raids, and it would just be a page or two. And then I'd read another book, and there'd be a similar kind of reference. And what I realized was nobody'd ever made any systematic attempt to chronicle the American air campaign against Japanese-occupied Hong Kong. And so that's where the book came from. My first book was about the U.S. Army Air Force's campaign against Japanese-occupied Hong Kong by the land-based aircraft and air crew of the 14th Air Force in China, and later the 5th Air Force in the Philippines. And then Target Hong Kong is about the U.S. Navy airstrikes on Hong Kong in 1945, January 1945. Right. And that's the subject of the book.
Okay, wow. I don't know quite where to start. Lots of questions that's raised for me, but maybe we'll answer that. I can ask those as we go on, because I'm pretty sure you'll answer the questions I was going to ask you. But let's then put some context around the wider war in the Pacific at that time, and Operation Gratitude. Can you just bring us some context around that, the air campaign over Hong Kong?
Yeah, I can. The context is essentially that the U.S. Army Air Forces began bombing Hong Kong as early as 1942. Okay. And continued to bomb Hong Kong throughout the rest of the war. The initial raids in 1942 were quite fleeting, did very little damage. There's a bit of a gap. And then in 1943, the China-based U.S. Army Air Forces, principally the 14th Air Force, began bombing Hong Kong in earnest and continued throughout the rest of the war. So there was this land-based bombing campaign against Hong Kong. And the goal, of course, was to, initially it was to suppress Japanese air assets. But over time, the goal shifted more towards hitting the port facilities and various Japanese convoys as they moved north and south from Japan to Southeast Asia. So this was ongoing.
Yeah.
The naval airstrikes against Hong Kong really only occurred once, and that was January 15th and 16th of 1945 as part of Operation Gratitude. Yeah. And the context of Operation Gratitude is entirely different and really quite disconnected from the Army Air Forces campaign. The quick synopsis is that at the start of 1945, the U.S. forces were positioned to invade Luzon and land at Lingayen Gulf in the north of Luzon. And there were two U.S. Navy fleets that were involved in this operation. And the third fleet was essentially the carrier fleet. It had Task Force 38, which was essentially the third fleet, and it was sometimes called the Fast Carrier Task Force. Yep. And there was the third fleet, and their job was basically to shield the seventh fleet, which was the fleet that was the invasion force. And so the seventh fleet obviously would be at the beachhead at Lingayen Gulf. The third fleet, Task Force 38, their job was to go into the South China Sea and suppress Japanese air assets and also intercept any attempts by the remaining Japanese surface fleet to attack the American invasion fleet. And so Admiral Halsey had command of Task Force 38. And at the start of January 1945, he took this fleet into the South China Sea. And this was the first time that U.S. surface units had been in the South China Sea since the very beginning of the war.
Yeah.
And
it'd been submarine activity, hadn't
there? Other than submarines, yep. That's right. Yep. That's correct. Yep. And Task Force 38 goes in and, you know, initially the job is to hit Japanese airfields and destroy Japanese aircraft on the ground, catch them in the air if possible, and basically shield the invasion fleet in as proactive a way as possible.
Yeah.
Well, while also looking for these Japanese surface combatants, which in the end never materialized. The Japanese declined to sortie. And so at that point, Admiral Halsey receives clearance to hit some alternate targets in the South China Sea, and those would be port facilities and any Japanese merchant marine convoys that might be moving through the South China Sea. Right. And so at this point, Halsey targets port cities like Saigon and also intercepts several convoys off the coast of French Indochina, and the air groups from his carriers completely destroy these convoys.
Yeah.
He then shifts his task force north a bit and targets Formosa as well as Hong Kong. And Hong Kong is really the center point, of course, of the book. And yeah. Specifically, it's those airstrikes of January 15th and 16th, 1945.
Let me take you back then, Steve, a little bit to talk about the structure of the carrier force from an aviation perspective, because one of the things you do in the book is you talk about the aircraft types, how they're separated, how they're structured. Can you just talk us through a little bit about how the carrier wings were structured, and then we can maybe talk about some of the individuals, because that's really what we want to do. But I think it's quite important to understand the aircraft types and their structure in their air wings, because it did change a little bit during Gratitude, didn't it?
A little bit, yeah. The carrier air groups on a fleet carrier, they were broken down into three different aircraft types. So a fleet aircraft carrier would have an air group. The air group, in turn, would have three squadrons. And that would be a squadron of fighter aircraft flying the F-6F Hellcat. There'd be a squadron, a dive bomber squadron, flying the SB2C Helldiver, and then there'd be a torpedo bomber squadron flying the TBM Avenger. And for the most part, that particular organization was the standard organization aboard the fleet carriers. There was some changes in exactly how many aircraft each squadron would have, and it was clear by the time Operation Gratitude was unfolding that the preference was shifting towards more and more Hellcats because they were able to function as highly capable fighter aircraft, but also as pretty capable fighter bombers as well. And one aircraft carrier, that I believe it was the Hancock, actually had its own fighter bomber squadron as well. And that was a organizational change that became more common as the war went on. As that organization suggests, they do have different functions. And the fighter aircraft typically are tasked with the job of clearing the skies of enemy aircraft. And that might mean a air umbrella over the fleet, or it might mean escorting the dive bombers and the torpedo planes into the target. They can also function as fighter bombers, and often did. But even in that role, they were often still, in a sense, functioning in a protective role again for the dive bombers and the torpedo bombers, since often when they went in as fighter bombers, they were suppressing anti-aircraft defenses. So in that sense, they were still protecting the bombers. Yeah. Dive bombers, as the name suggests, executed dive bombing runs, typically against ships, although because the carriers of Operation Gratitude were looking to degrade Japanese air assets, it meant they were often dive bombing airfields, hangars, and land-based air installations. The Avenger torpedo bombers, of course, when loaded with torpedoes, could go after ships, but they were really Swiss Army knives. I mean, a torpedo bomber like the Avenger could do so much more than torpedo bombing. They were used for example, they could be used as level bombers. They have a bomb bay, so they could fly at a higher altitude and do a level bombing run. They could do ground support runs because you could mount rockets on the wings. They, of course, could do anti-submarine work because they could carry a depth charge. They had radar, so they could do some kind of radar picket work. They could be scout planes. They were actually useful for rescue work, too, because the third crewman in the rear compartment could kick an extra life raft out the back door if they saw someone in the water. And they even at one point in I believe it was somewhere down in the Southwest Pacific, they were rigged up with these really primitive anti-crop spray duster units, where essentially they'd fly over Japanese like fields, rice paddies or crops, and spray diesel oil over them, because at that point the Japanese troops there were starving and they were growing their own food. Yeah. And, I mean, I found that story particularly incredible and sort of predictive too of how things would later unfold during the Vietnam War with Agent Orange and so on.
Interesting stuff. So let's get on to talk about some of the characters. And you start the book with the Brit, with good old Jonesy, who seems to be like the common thread that runs through a significant part of it, but he's nothing to do with the air campaign. But I thought it was a very interesting, his view of what happened and what unfolded was very interesting. And you really bring him to life, the troubles and tribulations of being on the ground for, the best part of 5 years in under captivity and under pretty stringent captivity. He's where it starts. But talk us through Jonesy and more importantly, some of the pilots, because that's really what this is about.
Yeah. Ray Jones, Raymond Eric Jones, I think you have it right. He's my through line character. He's the man whose story is threaded through the entire book, and he's my man on the ground. And because I realized as I was learning the stories of these naval pilots and getting a sense of their experiences, I realized that what I didn't have was an eyewitness on the ground. And Ray Jones, as it turns out, was the ideal person because he was literally an eyewitness. But I also had a transcript of his wartime diary, and I was in touch with his family, principally his daughter. So, you know, I had access to the things I needed to really get inside his head and tell his story in a pretty complete kind of way, because his story is fascinating, but also it complex is. And complicated. And so he's essentially the anchor of the book, I think. So his story is that he was from England, and he went to sea as a young man with the Royal Navy. He was a submariner. And he, as part of his service, he was in the Far East, including at Singapore. And it appears that he acquired a taste for exotic locations. And he may have visited Hong Kong during his service as well. I was never able to confirm that, but I suspect that yes, he did. And when he mustered out, he took a job, an expatriate position, with the prison services at Hong Kong, and he became a prison warden. So he's essentially a prison guard. And at the same time, though, he's maintained touch with his future wife, Marjorie Cumming, who he eventually does marry back in England, and he brings Marge, out to Hong Kong, and they set up house and live a fairly privileged expatriate life. And all's going well, except, of course, war clouds are boiling up on the horizon, and it gets to the point where many, not all, but many of the women and children of European descent in Hong Kong are evacuated. And it's somewhat of a mandatory evacuation, although not everyone agrees to go. But yep. Ray's pretty sure Marge should go, and so she does evacuate to Australia, where she gives birth to their daughter. And Ray is back in Hong Kong on the Stanley Peninsula, which is on the south side of Hong Kong Island. And the Stanley Peninsula is the site of the Stanley Prison, which is where Ray works. Ray is, like all British men resident in Hong Kong at that time, he's subject to military service. And in his case, he fulfills that duty by joining what's called the Stanley Platoon. And the Stanley Platoon is a special unit comprised of the prison guards, because most of them have military service backgrounds anyways. And so they train together as this Stanley Platoon. It's essentially a militia unit. I guess the equivalent in the United States would be a National Guard unit, Territorial Army, I guess, maybe in Britain.
Yeah.
And they drill together, and their role in wartime is to defend the Stanley Peninsula. And as it happens, the war does begin on December 8th. The Japanese military does come across the border to the north in Hong Kong. And within a relatively short time, they've overrun the mainland portion of Hong Kong, known as the New Territories, and Kowloon as well. They then come across the harbor and make an amphibious assault on Hong Kong Island itself. They cross through the center of the island, and then they are at the Stanley Peninsula. And waiting for them, among other units, is the Stanley Platoon with Ray Jones. And there's a vicious several days long battle for the Stanley Peninsula, and it's a fully automatic kind of battle. Everybody's very well armed, and it's bloody, it's violent, and the upshot is that by Christmas Day the defenders are exhausted, And that's true of the defenders elsewhere on the island as well.
Yeah.
And so the governor surrenders the colony on Christmas Day. Ray Jones at that point had been preparing for a last stand as the security detail for the Brigade HQ at Stanley. And he's quite relieved, actually, when the surrender happens, because he's been in the thick of the combat. And in his diary, he says something to the effect of, it's no fun to surrender, but it's nice to know I'm not going to be blown to pieces.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So he becomes a prisoner. But what's interesting is, of course, he's a combatant. He's a uniformed combatant. But somehow he ends up not in a prisoner of war camp. He ends up in the camp that holds all the Allied civilians instead. And I don't actually know why this happened. I do know that the Japanese were, you know, they weren't that interested in the details. They just wanted to kind of get people locked up. And so there was a certain randomness to it, a certain disorganization to it, a capriciousness even. But still, it's still a little bit of a mystery of how Ray Jones ends up in the civilian camp. And one possibility is that after the surrender, he and the other prison guards just went back to work, put on their prison guard uniforms, and were on duty at the prison. And that's where the Japanese found them, and they classified them as civilians. But I'm just supposing. I don't know that for a fact.
Yeah.
Did you know that the RP-3 rocket projectile, used to great effect by Hawker Typhoons in the tank-busting ground attack role, was originally conceived as an air-to-air weapon to attack Luftwaffe bomber streams? Did you also know that in the 1950s, an indigenous light aircraft built in the Philippines was skinned with woven bamboo matting? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
What's quite amazing about this story is, as we said, it's threaded through, and you keep coming back to Jonesy on occasion. But you do take the reader through everything that occupation entails as well. There's not much pleasure, but an awful lot of pain, an awful lot of discomfort, starvation, and things like that. So there's a great deal of depth to the journey that he goes on. And it is although we're here to talk about the aviation aspects of it, it's a fascinating insight to bring the air battle then into play. So let's talk about some of those key characters in the air then, because they were a very mixed bunch from different parts of the country. And again, you bring their journeys to life. Should we pick out a few just to bring them to life as well, to give the listeners a flavor for what's in the book?
Yeah. I think that, well, I got to know all of these people, all of these pilots,
really well. It comes through in the book. Yeah.
Perhaps.
Do you have a favorite?
I think the pilot that in many ways I feel the closest to would be Lieutenant Richard Hunt. And there's a couple of reasons why. One is that his plane crashed on Hong Kong Island. He bailed out. And I can tell that story in a moment. But his plane crashed on a ridgeline in Hong Kong Island. And many years later, in 2019, I visited the crash site. And so that was a unique experience because I'd never done that before. But also, this was the only character in the book where, I visited the place where his plane had crashed. I mean, this was a truly unique kind of experience.
Yeah. And there's still debris there, isn't there?
Yeah. It's what happened was the plane went down and Lieutenant Hunt bailed out. And the plane itself, when it hit the ridgeline, still had two crewmen inside. And they died in the crash. And their remains were recovered post-war by an MIA team. But the wreckage itself, I think in part because it was in a fairly inaccessible location, was just left there. And the plane was destroyed, but there was a lot of wreckage. It was an extensive debris field. But over time, as that area became Country Park and it sort of naturally regreened itself, and there were some reforestation efforts as well, the wreckage just kind of disappeared into the undergrowth and it was forgotten. And then years later, a aviation researcher / historian named Craig Mitchell rediscovered that wreck in the undergrowth. And eventually he took me up to see it. And it was an amazing experience because, for example, there was the armored headrest from the cockpit lying there in the dirt. It's just basically a triangular slab of steel designed to protect the pilot's head from fire coming into the aircraft from behind. So if a fighter plane was on his 6 o'clock and shooting into the plane, that would protect the pilot's head.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons, the headrest survived the crash because it's a big slab of armor. But when I sort of pried it out of the dirt and sort of, was holding it, I was thinking, this just isn't a piece of steel. And this isn't just a armored headrest from a cockpit. This is the armored headrest that Lieutenant Hunt's head was against as just like in the last second before he bailed out of his plane. And it was like this amazing sort of sense of connection there, knowing that I was holding not just some piece of a wrecked plane, but like a specific person's plane. And we knew the details of the plane too, like the bureau number and so on. So that was amazing. The other reason why I feel kind of connected to Richard Hunt, Lieutenant Richard L. Hunt's story, is simply because after the book was published, and this seems to be always the way these things go, I finally made contact with his family. And so I was able to read his wartime letters, which gave me this much greater sense, much deeper sense of who he was. And that, too, gave me a sense of connection with him. And I regret, I very much regret that I couldn't have got the contents of those letters into the book, but it just didn't happen in time. So maybe there's a magazine article about that to come. We'll see.
Or a reprint, maybe a reprint.
Yeah, or a second edition. That's right.
Yeah.
And one of the things I learned, and this is a good example of how if you only have military records to go on, you sometimes don't get details that can tell you so much about a person. Is that, of course, his name is Richard L. Hunt, right? And that's what all his military records say. But actually, as it turns out, his family knew him as Joe or Joe Dick. And again, I couldn't get that into the book in time, but I know that now.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? It's funny.
Yeah. And his story, of course, is it doesn't end well. I mean, and I think part of the purpose of the book, in a sense, is to tell his story and honor it, because he bails out of his aircraft over Hong Kong Island after colliding with a second aircraft flown by a squadron mate and close friend. And both planes crash. The only survivor is Lieutenant Hunt. He bails out this entire sequence, the collision, the bailout, Ray Jones sees from the ground. He witnesses this. And Lieutenant Hunt, in fact, is immediately captured. He's badly injured and he's put in Stanley Prison. And eventually he's shipped to Japan and he goes to Ofuna POW camp, which is the camp for pilots, submariners, and anybody the Japanese thinks might have some kind of valuable military intelligence information. He's completely neglected. I mean, he doesn't get any medical care. He's mistreated. He's starved. And he does die of this mistreatment and is buried on a temple in the temple grounds that are adjacent to the camp. So his story, you know, it doesn't end well. But yeah. He was a remarkable pilot, and I learned through his letters that you know he was a fully rounded human, so in that sense I was very honored to be able to tell his story.
Yeah, and there are four or five at least more stories like that again that run through the book and the whole tale of this campaign. So let's talk about the attacks on Hong Kong themselves, how on those 2 days in particular. How does this all unfold?
Yeah, the decision is made to strike the China coast. And so on January 15th, there are some initial fighter sweeps that go in. And these fighter sweeps go in over Hong Kong, and Ray Jones and the other prisoners witness this. The goal of the fighter sweeps is basically to suppress Japanese air assets, of which, as it turns out, there's very few. And air control, air dominance, air superiority is quickly established. On the 16th, that's when the full-strength airstrikes go in. And the goal is to strike a number of targets at Hong Kong, as well as at Canton. And there are also strikes flown against targets at Hainan as well.
Apologies for interrupting you there. Just one thing to put into that, though, that I think is worth noting for the listeners. And that is that although there wasn't a great deal of air cover, the Japanese were pretty impressive in how they laid their anti-aircraft guns and their anti-aircraft batteries up. They were very, very clever at how they did that. So this was not an easy run, was it? They may not have been attacked from the air, but by goodness, they certainly were put up against a serious foe from the ground and from the boats.
Yeah, this is certainly true. There was no real aerial opposition other than a few fighter sorties, but the anti-aircraft fire was intense. And so on the 16th, the fleet carriers are sending in multiple waves into Hong Kong, and the goal is to sink a tanker convoy that's taken refuge in Victoria Harbor. The goal is to pound the dockyards because Hong Kong had several modern and very large dockyards. The goal is to smash up Kai Tak Airfield and any aircraft that might be there. And the goal is, of course, to hit any oil storage facilities and the like. Strike A goes in. Strike B goes in the morning. Each is it's a traditional strike package. So it's Hellcats, dive bombers, torpedo bombers. They go in and they're principally targeting the dockyards, especially the Taikoo Dockyard, which is on the north shore of Hong Kong Island. And they definitely give it a good pounding. But it's an interesting example of how the Army and the Navy didn't seem to be talking to each other, or at least that conversation wasn't getting as far as Task Force 38. Because I think, to be fair, the Army and Navy were talking to each other, but the sort of tactical information didn't seem to be getting to Task Force 38 because there really was not much need to bomb the Taikoo Dockyard because, of course, the land-based army squadrons had been bombing it for several years and could continue to do so. It had already been pretty worked over. And in any case, the Japanese were so short of supplies that it was limited in what they could do in terms of dockyard work. So was it the best targeting decision? Well, perhaps not. But at any rate, the dockyards are thoroughly smashed up, especially the Taikoo Dockyard. Now, interestingly, in the morning during strikes A and B, virtually no aircraft are lost. The pilots are gobsmacked by the intensity of the aircraft anti-aircraft fire, and they're seeing
pleased to be out of there, aren't they?
Yes, yeah. I mean, they're just seeing like all kinds of colors in the air and all kinds of flak and tracer fire, and they're really surprised by this. But nonetheless, losses are very, very light, and what transpires is that there's then a gap at midday between strikes B and C. And during that time, the Japanese have time to rethink their tactics. And in the morning, more or less the approach had been to, essentially it was like firing a rifle at a pigeon. It was like one gun shooting at one plane and hope you hit it. And that wasn't working. And then over that midday break, there was a rethink of the tactics. And so when Strike 2C comes in, what they fly into is more of a box barrage kind of situation where the Japanese are forcing incoming planes to fly through a concentrated barrage of flak, which is a little bit of a different approach. And it's a bit like, you know, it's kind of like as if an aircraft's descending and it's punching through cloud layers, except in this case, the cloud layer is exploding flak. And the one reason this can work is because Hong Kong's topography kind of allows for it, because the harbor's in a bowl that's surrounded by mountains with two very narrow harbor mouths. So the Japanese kind of have a sense of how the planes will have to approach. And obviously, they know they're coming in from the sea as well. So during 2C, during strike 2C, which is the strike from the task group that includes the Hancock, that particular strike takes very heavy casualties. And this is the strike that includes the aircraft flown by Lieutenant Hunt that collides with his friend's aircraft and goes in. They lose a number of aircraft on that strike. And it's, of course, all the Japanese anti-aircraft fire, which is quite intense and quite effective.
Okay. Now, one of the things I also want to ask you to tell us a little bit about, well, I want to come back to the secondary targets, because they like any strike raid, they had primary and secondary targets. But tell us about the B-24 operations and the Mustangs as well.
Yeah, one of the interesting aspects of the strikes on January 15th and 16th, 1945, by the Navy on Hong Kong is that there were simultaneous strikes by the 118th Tactical Reconnaissance Squadron of the 14th Air Force, which was based in China. But what's interesting is that while the U.S. Navy's effort was massive, involving hundreds of aircraft, the 118th Tactical Reconnaissance Squadron, I mean, on January 16th, they sent in four planes. And what's more, they didn't seem to know the Navy was there. And again, I think it's just that, tactically speaking, there wasn't really a way to coordinate the movements of a carrier task force with the movements of a single squadron based in the boonies in China. And particularly not when for that information to be useful, it would have to be passing very fast. And so at any rate, the 118th doesn't seem to know the Navy's there. And so during that midday gap between strikes B and C, four Mustang pilots come in.
You can't write it, can you?
And they know they need to come in on the deck, of course, because they're going to skip bomb. But they don't seem to know this tanker convoy's there either, because the tanker convoy has come into the harbor precisely to escape the carriers offshore. And so these four Mustangs come into a harbor that is much more heavily defended than they expected. And they immediately get shot to pieces and start losing people. And as far as I can tell, I think they lost, if I'm recalling correctly, two of the four planes were lost, and the other two did return to the base. But as far as I can tell from all the read-ups of their documents that I have made, they just didn't know the Navy was there. But what's interesting about that is that this tells us that that was a big gap between strikes.
If a
group of four Mustangs could come in, launch a strike, get shot up, and escape all without seeing the Navy, then we know it was a big gap. And it was that time that allowed the Japanese to rethink their AA tactics.
Right. Okay. And I mentioned the Liberators and the PBYs got a soft spot for a Liberator, but they also from mainland China were operating over Hong Kong, weren't they?
Yes. There were the B-24s, and then there were the B-24s used by the Navy as well. So in China, we've got the B-24s of the 14th Air Force that would often fly sea sweeps out over the South China Sea, and they were looking for Japanese ships to attack, and they would sometimes overfly Hong Kong, and in fact, they often, if they didn't find any Japanese ships offshore, they would overfly Hong Kong as they were heading back into China and unload their unexpended bombs on targets in Hong Kong. So there were many one-plane raids on Hong Kong, because the sea sweeps, it was typically one aircraft goes out, radar-equipped at night, tries to find a Japanese ship to attack. If they don't, they then hit Hong Kong when they're inbound. So there's those aircraft, but in the Philippines, there's the Navy-based B-24s as well, and they're flying long-range recon runs across the South China Sea, and they do go all the way to the South China coast. So we really have B-24s coming in from both, the West and the East during Operation Gratitude.
Okay. And let's talk then about those secondary targets, because they had secondary targets. In some instances, it was Kai Tak and places like that. But also, as they were returning, they overflew Portuguese Macau, which was neutral. Lots of air quotes going on. Tell us about how that unfolded, because that came back to be a bit of a black spot on the whole program, didn't it?
Yeah, Macau at that time was a Portuguese colony, and Portugal was neutral. So Macau was basically, I think, the only place in Asia that was neutral, and it's a tiny little place. Anyone who's been to Macau will tell you that it's the size of a postage stamp. And this was quite different from Europe, where there were quite a few neutral powers that were choosing to sit the war out, Sweden and Switzerland and Portugal and Spain and Ireland and Turkey and so on. And then in Asia, it's just Macau. And so I don't think anybody in the Navy was used to thinking of neutral territory. And so in the lead up to the strikes against Hong Kong, the intelligence briefings given to the pilots about Macau are not terribly accurate. And that's not the fault of the intelligence officers. It's just they were going off what they had. And so what was conveyed to the pilots flying fighter sweeps to the south of Hong Kong, which would take them over Macau, is that depending on how they were briefed, they were getting information like, it's Portuguese, but the Japanese have occupied it, or it's Portuguese, but the Japanese are using the air facilities.
Yeah.
And so the pilots get this sense that Macau is, it's a legitimate target. And it's further complicated by the fact that the pilots know that the Japanese typically hide their aircraft along the edges of airfields. They conceal them, essentially. And so what the Hellcat pilots have learned is that if you want to suppress Japanese air assets and you're doing it by going in after an airbase, then you can't just shoot at visible planes. You have to basically shoot everything, just strafe any buildings, and then maybe even just shoot up the greenery around the edges of the airfields and hope you catch something under a camouflage net. And this is standard procedure. And the pilots assume that applies to Macau. And Admiral Bogan, who commands the task group that includes the Hancock, knows the pilots operate this way, and he gives specific orders that they can only shoot up planes at Macau if they see a plane. They don't have permission to shoot up buildings at random. But that order doesn't get to the pilots. And so they come in hot over Macau, and they see a pair of seaplane hangars by the outer harbor. They don't see any planes, but they see seaplane hangars, and they make the logical conclusion, which is that they must be hiding something of value. And they then shoot up the hangars, and then they come back and do it again. And then they do it a third time. And the hangar, one of the two hangars burns up, and the other one's pretty full of holes. Yeah. First hangar belongs to the Portuguese Navy, and the second hangar is actually the property of Pan American Airways from the pre-war Clipper service. So Portugal is not happy about this, and it triggers an international incident. There's a court of inquiry, and the skipper of the air group for the Hancock is called before the inquiry and is kind of called to task. And eventually the U.S. does pay up for damage to Macau post-war. It's about a quarter of $1 million.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Steve, as we go to wrap up, there are a number of other investigations into the activities. But looking back, what's your view as a historian, looking back on Operation Gratitude? What's your view of the impact and some of the failures and successes of that whole raid and target Hong Kong?
Well, I mean, in the grand sense, Operation Gratitude clearly accomplished its purpose, right? Because it did shield the invasion force, and it did prevent any Japanese surface fleet from going after the invasion force. It suppressed Japanese air assets. So in the grand scheme, it I think was a success. In terms of that actual strike against Hong Kong, I think militarily it probably didn't accomplish a whole lot. I say that because the Army Air Forces did and had been bombing Hong Kong. And so the Navy, it wasn't really necessary for the Navy to do it. It is true that because the Navy was in the South China Sea, they were able to really efficiently and ruthlessly destroy the Japanese merchant ship convoys that were in the South China Sea. And again, the Army could have done that too, but the Navy was able to do it much more rapidly and efficiently. And that was strategically significant, although, again, not really a game changer. But it is true that Task Force 38 completely destroyed several convoys along the coast of French Indochina and did wreck four of the five tankers that were at Hong Kong. And tankers were a vital strategic asset by that point for the Japanese. And really, the book captures, I would say, that the final moments of the Japanese merchant marine, where the last convoys are desperately trying to get either from Japan to Southeast Asia or from Southeast Asia to Japan. And Convoy HI-87, which is the convoy that was in Hong Kong, was one of the very last of those fast tanker convoys. And ultimately, it's completely destroyed. Four of the five tankers are wrecked at Hong Kong. The fifth tanker makes it to Singapore and is sunk there. And so that's, at that point, the Japanese merchant marine is pretty well decimated.
And you do go into some detail. I mean, war is a terrible thing, whichever way you look at it. There's some collateral damage, not only in Macau, but also in Hong Kong as well, which I wouldn't say was inevitable, but you also do a really good job of explaining some of that. So thank you so much, Steve. Not only enjoyed our chat here, but I absolutely loved the book. Read it from cover to cover, in the bath, on the train, and any spare moment. It's a great read because it's written with a thriller style, but on the basis is a historical fact as well. So it's an unusual, I did find it quite unusual in the style, but quite gripping in that I couldn't put it down. So highly recommended, and thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us about it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music and Mick Oakey, the Aviation Historian, for his support. We'd also like to thank Simon Jakubowski of the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club, and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Ellie, and Gareth on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Threads, and Instagram feeds. And Steve, just before we let you go, where can we find the book online?
Well, probably the simplest place to find it is to go to Osprey's website and use their internal search engine to type in Target Hong Kong, and you'll pull the book up. That's either in the UK or North America. They each have their individual Osprey websites, and the book can be ordered from either place.
And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Steve.
Yep. Thanks again for having me on the show. It was my pleasure.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science, and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.